But I think we've been held up in caucus and on the floor, and the senators are, I'm certain, trying to get through the lunch line to get something and bring it up and gobble it down and get here as fast as they can. But because we're already behind by 30 minutes, I think we better begin with budget plan reports and federal stimulus fund report that Senator Pappas asked you to prepare and present to the committee today. So I understand that the University of Minnesota and MNSCU would like to do both sections 1 and 2 of this agenda together. Is that correct? And who would you like to begin? University of Minnesota, do you want to begin? Are they going to do it together? We can both come up at the same time. Welcome, Richard Futzenreuter, right?
Futzenreuter. Fitz for short.
From the University of Minnesota, and Laura King from the MNSCU system. Okay, great. Thank you.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I'll begin by drawing your attention to one particular slide. I'll bounce between that and a budget update to give you an overview first of how what the university is doing to meet the budget targets. And I want to just start with this slide to point out that the journey that we're on, that we've chosen to report in our December 15th report, is the journey that we've taken to go from the $702.6 million base all the way down to the $591.1 million base funding that'll likely emerge out of this session. Now, you may recall that the legislation that you adopted last year had a base for the University of Minnesota of $670 million in 12 and 13. So what the legislation actually required us to do is describe how we were going to arrive at that base. But that base, which is part of the forecast deficit for 12 and 13, is, in our judgment, not a base we ought to be planning to arrive at. So we've chosen in the report that's, I believe, in your packets, is to establish our recurring budget for fiscal 12 and 13 at $591.1 million. On the way to getting to that number, I'll just highlight some actions that we have taken in the current fiscal year that's included in our report, and it's the fact that we've had to make reductions of nearly $90 million this fiscal year in the university's budget. We've eliminated faculty, cut staff and student positions with layoffs, retirements, and the elimination of open positions. We were, I think, fortunate in the fact that we started an early retirement incentive program in the spring of a year ago before the legislature had even actually cut our budget, and that allowed us to get a jump start on eliminating positions. But in the budget plan that we have that we're implementing in the current fiscal year, we've reduced nearly 1,200 positions. We've reconfigured service points in the libraries, cut back on the number of service points for students and the public. We've eliminated software maintenance and support costs for our financial system. We've implemented a hiring freeze in the Office of Information Technology and cut 34 positions. In the College of Liberal Arts, as an example, in the current fiscal year, they've retrenched or cut back and not filled 22 vacant faculty lines. They've cut back 22 non-instructional staff. They've eliminated some instructional staff and reduced supply and expense budgets. In the Institute of Technology, we've had to take steps there to reduce 17 faculty positions that became vacant and weren't filled. They've cut approximately 20 staff position and departments inside the Institute of Technology. They've cut TA budgets substantially and many other cuts in some of the other collegiate units. I'm not going to, at this point, take you through an exhaustive list of those cuts, but those are the examples of items that we outlined in our report that we took just to arrive at the $623 million base that's on this particular chart. Now, if I could, Madam Chair and members, draw your attention to the next packet and talk about what our next step is in this journey of arriving at $591.1 million as our base that we'd be establishing next fiscal year, that we would assume would be the base that we'd start from in fiscal 12 and 13, even though your legislation actually doesn't establish, neither the House bill or the Senate bill establishes the university's base at that 591 figure. In current law, as I said, that figure is $670 million, and the governor's recommendation is to be at 591, but each, the House and the Senate, have established different numbers. If you turn to the second slide in my larger handout, I've shared this slide with you before, and this is really the budget challenge that we face next fiscal year. And as I've pointed out to you, that challenge is $132.3 million. It's made up partly of the budget cut that you're implementing on us this year, or for fiscal 11, that's in the your Senate recommendation, is the governor's recommendation, is also the House recommendation on our reduction in our appropriation for fiscal 11. But it's also made up of expenditure needs and, of course, our famous 27th pay period issue. The solution to that challenge for the university, again, all with an eye of landing at that $591 million state appropriation base, about 35% or just under $47 million will come from increased tuition revenue. That's both rate and volume changes, credit hours, et cetera. And about 65% of that solution will come, $85.4 million, through budget reductions and non-recurring actions. If you turn to the next slide.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
Just on that slide, because I think that's an important one, Mr. Fitzenreiter. So tuition is 35% of the solution. And within that 35% is what you described as volume. We have more attendees, more students.
Madam Chair, Senators, we have in the current fiscal year, for an example, an increase of about 4% in enrollment. Minsky has a large increase as well. So we will see some volume increase. It's not a great part of the fiscal 11 solution, but there will be some.
That's where I was going, Senator Thompson. Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
So of, can you help me this way? Of the 35%, how much of that is just a pure tuition increase?
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Madam Chair, Senators, I'd say probably 97% of it's rate related. 95 to 97%. Now, I want to remind folks that for Minnesota resident undergraduates, and we'll talk about this when we get to the stimulus discussion, we buy the rate down for Minnesota resident undergraduates per the law down to 4.5% for those students.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, proceed.
Madam Chair, if you turn to the next page, again, this is all about that journey to get to the 591. I was here just 2 days ago talking about the plan for compensation and how we were going to meet part of that budget challenge, roughly $28 million through, as you can see on this chart, the furlough and one-time pay reductions will be about 22%, $18.5 million. We talked about that just 2 days ago. The delay in the faculty compensation increase for 6 months will save another $9.7 million. That's the 11%. So that was that $28 million. The remaining part of the challenge is going to be addressed primarily, as you can see on this chart, 52% of it, or roughly $44 million, will be dealt with through budget reductions. And those budget reductions will average right now. We have instructions out to some 50-odd major budgetary units at the university. They'll average around 2.75%. Now, that 2.75% comes on top of a 5.5% reduction that units undertook for the current fiscal year. If you turn to the next page, where we are in our process at the University of Minnesota is, in the fall, we undertake budget reviews with what we call the support service units. That's everything from the Board of Regents to the President's Office to the HR Office to the Budget Office and Controller's Office and Student Finance, et cetera. That process goes on in the fall, and those units have been assigned their 2.75% reduction. It totals about $7.6 million that is coming out of these units as part of that 2.75% reduction for next year. The academic units, we are in budget discussion, as you can see on this chart, in February through the end of March here in early April. We meet with each one of them, with the deans and the senior vice presidents and provost, to go through their budget issues, their proposals for reductions. I can't share with you today any specific details about those reductions, as they're still in discussion between the academic leaders about what exactly they will or won't agree to do as they reduce their budgets. In our system inside the university, they're given a budget target. They're told to come back with recommendations on how to address that reduction, and then the provost and the president ultimately make the decision as to what is implemented and not implemented in that process. I will tell you that I think the cuts, and my general observation on the cuts next year, is they won't be as severe on reducing employees as they have in the past. We've been working very hard to hold positions vacant as they become available so we can avoid laying off folks in this rather tough economic environment. With that, Madam Chair, that just gives you a picture, a very broad stroke view of what we're doing to, again, arrive at that $591 million level for 12 at the end of this by next, at the end of the current biennium, to prepare ourselves again for what will be a tough budget situation in 12 and 13. And with that, Madam Chair, I could continue on to talk about what we're doing on stimulus or defer a little bit to my colleague, or just keep going on the stimulus, what we're doing with that money.
Well, why don't we let you rest your voice for a while, okay, and hear from Ms. King.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon, members. My name is Laura King. You should have in front of you a document that has our watermark on the front, legislative report summary of 2012-2013 budget planning. Do you find it there? I see some of you paging through it. As we heard from the university, this report was compiled in response to legislation that was in the omnibus bill last year, asking us to address our budget planning in preparation for the 2012-2013 biennium. And there was a number attached to our target for 12 and 13 that we recognized pretty soon in the process was not a realistic target for us. And so we adjusted our planning internally to aim toward a number that seemed more likely to be the outcome of both this legislative session and the state's economic condition. When the bill closed, we had $614 million for fiscal 10 and $666 million for fiscal 11, along with $79 million in federal stimulus funds. We also had a $655 million a year base planning number on the worksheets for 12 and 13. We are, in our instructions to the campuses, asking them to aim for $594 million for fiscal 12 and 13. So like the university, we have a difference between perception and reality in our planning process. That 594 is a result both of the unallotment and the budget reduction that's currently moving through session, and represents the target that we've given to the campuses for their 12 and 13 planning prior to two more revenue forecasts and another biennial budget legislative session. So in some schools, that number is believed to still be too high for planning purposes. If we are faced with another reduction as we go into the next biennial budget, we will at least have a starting planning target that's closer to the end of the story than the number that was in the worksheets and in the bill last year. If you look on page 4 of our document, you'll see the work that's been going on with the campuses. We issued instructions to the campuses last fall after some discussions with our board about our expectations for their budget planning for both fiscal 11 as well as expectations for 12 and 13, and we've summarized those instructions for you on page 4 in the document. For fiscal 11, we targeted $605 million as the appropriation expectation, and we were pretty close to that once the unallotment and the additional budget reduction this year occurred. We, as per law last year, instructed the campuses to assume a 5% tuition increase in 11, and then we used some of the federal stimulus money to buy down the student consequence of that number. We recognize in our fiscal 11 budget very modest tuition increases, and I understand, Madam Chair, and thank you, by the way, for letting me scoot out of here Tuesday. I understand you had a good exchange with my colleague about compensation events in the system this biennium. That translates for us into a very modest year-over-year total compensation cost increase in 11, and the schools are working with that. We suggested to the schools that they should expect the federal stimulus money to be available in 11, but you'll see that in our instructions for 12 and 13, we withdraw that expectation. We don't expect the federal stimulus money to re-enter in 12 and 13. And then perhaps most importantly, from where I sit and from where the board sits, there was very strong instructions to the campuses that one of their imperatives for planning for 11 and 12 and 13 was preservation of their fund balance. We have had a board policy now for over 10 years about expectations on fund balance, and our direction to the schools has been do not use that up. Use it as bridge financing, as transition financing, but know that we're going to expect you to have some fund balance left when this is all hopefully behind us. That's a very important tool for our campuses, and the board's position and our position is to reinforce how important that is by putting it out there as a high standard. You'll see that on page 5, the assumptions that we asked the schools to work with for 12 and 13. Again, targeting $594 million in state appropriation, which is really substantially below the number that came out of last session. Further, we gave them some instructions about how to model additional state appropriation reductions under a set of scenarios, given the outlook for the state, given higher ed's participation in the state budget. We gave them some tools to think about additional reductions. We also instructed them to use inflation assumptions that are consistent with what's coming out of the Minnesota Management and Budget. But then we go on to say that we would expect those to be adjusted if there's some local conditions that govern their cost structure. We also have not given them explicit instructions on tuition for 12 and 13. Our planning assumption to them was to be reasonable. And reasonable in our world really means be very sensitive to what's happening with students, what's happening with debt loads, and the general board position that tuition increases should be held down to the greatest extent possible. We did not get any more explicit than that, Madam Chair, because there is such tremendous uncertainty for us about 12 and 13 from the state budget standpoint. And we were very reluctant to give them hard direction, which could well translate into budget cuts and reductions that you would find intolerable. So we left it a little ambiguous at this juncture. As we get closer to the next legislative session and as some of the numbers start to settle down, we might have more more clarity behind that direction. But as you read these narratives, you won't see a tuition number assumed for 12 and 13 at any of the schools. It's embedded in their assumptions, but we didn't ask them to tell us what they used, and we all are just sort of agreeing that at this point we're a little vague about tuition. And then finally, we assumed that there would be no new federal stimulus funds in 12 and 13. And so those are the assumptions that are baked into the narratives that you have for the schools. And they have walked through this budget process with their campuses. Like the timetable you saw from Fitz, we start very upstream at the campus level and with our presidents, consulting with students, consulting with faculty, talking to our community partners. So we're now very close to having our fiscal 11 budget in our hand, and we go to the board with it next month. So their planning process started probably 7 months ago. They similarly have already started their consultation work with campuses and with students and staff and faculty for 12 and 13. So our planning process is, we have to make some assumptions because the legislative process happens on its schedule and our needs internally happen on a different schedule. You can see that the $594 million planning estimate that we're using for 12 and 13 would return the system to its fiscal 2003 funding level, and that's in the presence of about 20,000 more students. In dollars per FYE terms, we'll have declined from $3,700 per FYE from $4,500 per FYE. So we have a funding decline of about 16%, and these are just in nominal dollars. And if you add in the effects of inflation, you see an even sharper decline over the last 8 years. Because of the looming deficit at the state level, we assume that there will be more discussions like this next year, and we are continuing our efforts both to control costs and to find new external revenue sources as we model the 12 and 13 results. On page 6 and 7, you'll see a recitation of all the different strategies that the campuses have used, both in the last couple of years as well as in the years that they're thinking about now. The strongest one for us, unfortunately, is the elimination of positions. Because we are a very labor-intensive business, most of our costs are labor costs. And so when it comes time to bring costs down, that forces us to look at labor as a last choice, certainly, but it's so much of our costs that we have to look there.
Ms. King, I'm surprised at one of the items, which is minimize need for adjunct faculty. I would have thought that adjunct faculty is cheaper than tenured faculty professors and that you would see an increase in use of adjunct faculty.
Madam Chair, we have seen both. We have seen an increase in adjunct faculty in some places, particularly where an enrollment increases have been very rapid. Mm-hmm. But the goal of minimizing the use of adjunct faculty is related to the goal of really managing curriculum so that you have full classes and you staff them with full-time faculty and you don't have what maybe 10 years ago was a more typical class size that you could put an adjunct faculty member into. So that's the relationship between those two goals.
I just have to say, since I am an adjunct faculty, that my class size 10 years ago was probably 22, and it's now 31, 32. So,
Madam Chair, that's what's happening.
It's
that's
definitely
exactly what's happening.
Maximizing.
That's right. That's right.
Good.
That's an important tool for us, but our goal is to do everything we can on the fringes so that our full-time employees are preserved to the greatest extent. We also have worked in the last couple of years. Certainly, we've seen very strong enrollment increases, and we've tried to manage those with very limited increases in faculty and staff overall. And you'll see throughout the document, on a school-by-school basis, you'll see information about what has been the change in employment levels at the college or university. And if you look at those tables in comparison to the change in enrollment, you can see that they're not linear. We've had very strong enrollment increases and very level or slightly increasing enrollment employment increases. So we've tried to manage those two together. And we've also made a great use of technology and hope to continue to use technology, not so much to enable us to lower our employment levels as it is to bring in new services without having to bring in new employees. That's the more effective strategy for us with technology. We also have done a lot of work, and will continue to do this work, around right-sizing the campuses, and that's our language for really understanding what the long-term enrollment trend is for that campus, identifying what that translates into from a physical plant standpoint, and working to bring the two into alignment. It's been a disappointment to us that we've had trouble getting support in the legislature for our bonding requests for demolition. We've been trying very steadily to demolish and to shrink some of our physical plants, and that's all part of the right-sizing initiative. We've also continually reallocated, and I believe you'll see on the bottom of this of each of the campus pages, you'll see some information about how much reallocation has gone on. That's a continuing strategy for us as well. Our primary concern in thinking about 12 and 13 is the pressure we have with the conflict between resources and enrollment. We've had very strong enrollment increases, and it's not been just limited to the metro area. We've had increases across the state, and we are reaching the point where we've really exhausted our ability to respond to that enrollment increase with the resources that are available to us. And so that's what's before us, Madam Chair, in the next several years, both watching what happens to enrollment to see if that census stays up or if it starts to drop as the economy improves, and then planning for how we will manage that on a long-term basis. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll pause. There's a data sheet here for each of the colleges and universities, along with a narrative, and you'll also see on page 10 and 11 an overall system summary that just sort of racks up all the individual campus reports.
Ms. King, while I have you here, I understand that the House is...
It's always an ominous start, Mr. Chair.
The House is proposing a $3 million cut in the central office of the $10 million. And last time you were here, we had talked about your intention was to take $1 million out of the central office. You know, we have talked a lot in our committee about shared services that the central office provides. What will a, you know, off the top of your head, what will a $3 million cut mean?
Madam Chair, the $1 million that we talked about last when we were together represents the percentage that the system office budget is of state appropriation,
right.
What we characterize as a fair share. Mm-hmm. The $3 million, the number in the House, of course, then is three times that calculation. If we had freedom to distribute that reduction inside of our different cost centers, it would likely land very heavily on the technology program, because that's more than half of the spending that we have in the central accounts. And it would have a deleterious effect on our ability to move forward with the Students First initiative, which goes to student requests for registration and bill paying and single screen from multiple institutions. It would slow us down.
Okay, is that all you have to present for?
That concerns the March 15th
right.
report. Yes, ma'am.
That's the March 15th report. We have a student who wanted to comment at this point in the agenda, so let's pause to see if Jake Height from Monona State is here.
Okay.
And maybe, Ms. King, why don't you stay there? And Mr. Height, why don't you just bring up another chair? Because we're going to go back to the two of you. Welcome, Mr. Height.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
I'm going to just point that microphone toward you. Great. Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. My name is Jake Height. I'm a student from Winona State University, as well as I am attached to the 34th Infantry Division, Main Command Post out of Rosemount Armory. This morning, I would just like to bring to your attention and the student concerns that we have with the appropriation cuts. Before we start that, we as students are not pointing fingers. We are not saying it is anyone's fault, but we do want to make the legislature and this committee aware of what these effects are having to students. I do believe that there's a document going around right now, and so I'm just going to walk through.
So, Mr. Height, are you here today representing MSUSA?
I am here today representing MSUSA, yes. So I'm just going to walk through this document of the appropriation cuts and what our students have brought forth to MSUSA and to our board of directors and saying these are the areas that we see on our campuses. The first one would be a reduction of course offerings and increased class sizes. Winona State University, we've seen students taking longer to graduate, which is costing the state, their institution, and the student more money for the exact same level of education that they would be paying for. In addition, we've seen larger class sizes. Another example at Winona State University is the anatomy and physiology classes. They don't have enough seats available where the classes are actually overflowing into the aisles, and they're having to bring chairs in from the halls. With faculty and staff reductions, we see at Southwest State University, the College of Business and Professional Studies has not received a new faculty member in 3 to 4 years. This includes our departments like business, political science, economics, and public administration. They aren't refilling these positions once a professor leaves this institution. On the next page, we have things like, on the student services and the reductions to those. With financial aid, students are having a 2 to 3 week waiting period for face-to-face assistance with their financial aid to pay for that education that they're working so hard for. In child care for our non-traditional students who may be going back due to this economy, we have cut of $50,000 from its budget.
And members may recall that we actually put another $500,000 into child care last year.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With fewer hours of operation, the Student Center and the library at Southwest State are being cut. St. Cloud State, however, is also looking at doing this next year. And we have increased fees and charges for service. Again, in our anatomy and physiology classes at Winona State University, the students now have to pay for their own lab gloves, goggles, things along those lines that the department just cannot afford to provide anymore. And with public safety, at St. Cloud State, the Safe Ride program, which provides transportation to and from the campus from various aspects in the community, is going to be significantly reduced. Work, study, and student help, which so many students rely on to be able to pay for and fund their education, is also going to be cut. At Winona State, we've seen them almost cut in half in various areas. Reductions in student wages place this financial burden. And we've heard that most student universities across the system, or student state universities across the system, are going to be proposing these as well.
Mr. Height, is that in preparation for the state cuts? Because we actually put $2.5 million more into work study, and I think the federal government also did. So were you having a shortage even with the additional money, or is this in anticipation of the cuts?
Work studies has always been very competitive and very hard to get to begin with, and the money was able to create more jobs, in my understanding. However, they're being cut back to only having maybe 4 to 5 hours on a given campus. I worked a work study job for about 4 hours was all the department could afford.
I spoke to a St. Catherine student today, too, who also said she was only getting 4 hours a week of work study.
Yes, Madam Chair. And on our final one with our graduate students that bring some prestige and abilities to our undergrad students in teaching and fostering, we have Minnesota State University Mankato has been eliminating a lot of their assistantships, which are so vital. And the financial assistance of teaching, of TAs in the classroom, in addition to the experience, is vital to that continued success for that university. So what will the future bring? The initial picture of how our recent cuts have affected the Minnesota State Universities and the students attending them raises concerns as how to the quality, affordability, and accessibility of the education these institutions provide. We will be affected as further steps are taken to balance the campus budgets. MSUSA will continue to gather information how these findings impact students and hope solutions can be found in the present appropriation reduction that does not place unnecessary burdens on our students. It is well recognized that there is a need to maintain the quality of education the students of these universities receive. And I'll be happy to answer any questions that the committee or yourself, Madam Chair, might have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Height. I, too, have heard a lot of these stories from students, the long lines to get financial aid and also the lack of training for some of the student workers who are providing advice on financial aid where people aren't getting really accurate advice.
Yes, Madam Chair.
But I have not heard so much about the work study and the child care stuff, except I did hear today about limited hours and work study. So thank you. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Height? Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Height, I've asked this to other people as they've been here to testify, and know that everyone here, I think, is really concerned about the escalating tuition costs and impact on students and families, and a lot of us around the table have kids in college. The question I would ask you and your organization is to have discussion about, when we're talking about what is the future going to bring, we're looking at about a 2% cut this year. We'll be coming back next year looking at a potential 20% cut. We have a projected deficit that's just gigantic. So we're going to all be hoping for these days
miracle
next year. So the question is, what are we going to look like in the future? What we cannot continue to provide the same things that we're doing right now as much as we want to. I think we need to have really serious discussions at every level about what's going to change, what's going to go away, how are we going to do things, how are we going to network, and what will we really put our resources into and commit to, and what will we need to pass on? So I encourage your organization as well to start having those conversations internally.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Hyde.
Senator, I agree, and we have been having those conversations internally and discussing and trying to figure out where aspects of the universities and of the systems. But I'm sure, like yourselves, we have no solutions that we've come up with. And having the system, the students, and all the stakeholders of the MNSCU system coming together and talking and discussing is going to be very key. And I completely agree with you, Senator.
Well, and you really want students to have good advice from their advisors about how to organize their schedule so that they can graduate. But if you have to wait 2 or 3 weeks before you can get into an advisor to see an advisor, then it may be too late. So it's a quandary. Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, Ms. Wright, in terms of your testimony as to, and I like Senator Erickson-Ropes and Senator Pappas, agree in terms of understanding some of what you're going through. Do you have any differences with kind of the broad outlines that Ms. King offered in terms of MNSCU as to where they're going to have to look for cuts?
Mr. Height.
Senator, I'm not sure as to what the question are you saying is this results of what the cuts are to the from the central office? Or
I think you looked at the report, and do you have any concerns or disagreements with what Ms. King is
proposing?
Would
you do things differently than what is being presented to this committee by Ms. King on behalf of MNSCU?
Mr. Height.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Currently, we work very closely with MNSCU, with our university relations, and so everything that we sit down and we talk about it, and they do seek the opinion of the students and discuss. So we have been part of this up until this point.
Okay. So your concern is not
Senator Cohen.
MNSCU is trying to implement budget cuts. Your concern is with the cuts imposed on MNSCU by the governor and the legislature.
Mr. Height.
We are not pointing fingers with this testimony. We're not saying that the blame falls on anyone or any particular. We are simply trying to state the case of this is how students are now. This is what we're having to deal with at this present moment that we're fighting against as students. It's the nature of the game sometimes, whether it be, you know, whose fault is no one for me to point the finger at.
Senator Cohen.
Let me do that for you then. understand that you're not trying to finger point. So but certainly what I infer from your comments then is the fault lies here and with the governor in terms of the budgets we're imposing on higher education and the cuts we're making in higher education. And obviously we've had these debates in this Senate now for the last several years as to what happens with budget cuts, but your suggestion is, or your testimony is that given the reality as imposed on MNSCU and the MNSCU campuses by virtue of what the governor and legislature have done, you're beginning to find yourself in a very untenable position as a student.
Mr. Height.
given the results of what has happened over the last biennium and with the budget cuts that we have had, that is, this is the position that we do find ourselves in, yes.
Mr. Cohen,
well,
Senator
so,
Cohen.
So, Madam Chair, it gets into the larger issue of where we're going with the state budget and what the priorities are and what kind of money we have to work with. And that's the difficulty we're having. That whatever the cliche is, you can't fit the square peg in the round hole, or if the cliche is vice versa, that's where we find ourselves. And what we're hearing from Mr. Hyde is somebody at the receiving end of all this, from government legislature to Minsku to individual campus to individual student, is what we're hearing throughout these budget divisions, and it's getting tiresome.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Now I'd like to go back to Mr. Fitzenrider on the federal stimulus funds.
Madam Chair, members, if you turn to page 5 of the bigger handout.
This one?
Yep. I'll pick up from there and talk about the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. And, you know, it's a gloomy atmosphere with respect to funding of higher education, but there is some good news for Minnesota. I checked these numbers this morning, and as of this morning, the university has been awarded 279 specific awards that relate to the stimulus dollars. These are awards for research activity. It's $141 million so far, 279 awards, and our success rate on the dollar amount that we've asked for in those proposals is 82%. We're getting 82% of the dollar amount we're asking for. We're very proud of this. About, I'd say 3 months ago, the awards were down in about 34 awards. So we can feel and see that the stimulus money flowing out of the federal government is picking up pace, and we're doing very well in our judgment with those dollars. And these dollars will help Minnesota's economy. We will do the research over several years, but this is a good news story for Minnesota.
Well, this may be too specific a question, but so you don't always get the full dollar amount you ask for, but how many awards did you ask for? Do you know what your percentage is of awards requested?
Madam Chair, I can get that number. I do not know that off the top of my head. I know we're doing very well,
okay.
And it's still early. There are still more dollars to come.
And this is wide-ranging research projects?
Across the university, yes. Obviously, the bulk of it's going to be located in places like the medical school, IT, College of in agriculture, but it's pretty wide across the university.
Okay, Senator Weaker.
Thank you. Madam Chair, that is great news. Are you able to indicate how many jobs this might be? I'm sure Senator Michelle would be interested in that, too, for how many jobs from this money.
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't have those specific numbers with me today. There's a formula, and it's, of course, as everybody knows, been debated quite a bit about how you report a job. We'll get those numbers for you based on how they ask us to report that. That's on the grant side, the research award side. I want to turn my attention to the second half, and that's the money that we received through the state fiscal stabilization funds. As you know, the state of Minnesota was the prime recipient of that and was awarded substantial sums of money. The legislature last year apportioned those dollars between the University of Minnesota, Minsku, and K-12 education, and the University of Minnesota in particular received $89.3 million from the state fiscal stabilization funds. You turn to page 6, we actually received that, oddly enough, that's how you folks appropriated it. We received $601,000 from the government services fund. That's as fungible as the second bucket, the education stabilization fund. Our goals in using that money was to save jobs, mitigate tuition impacts, ensure transparency and accountability, and we are required to report because the state's the prime recipient. We actually report to the MMB, Minnesota Management and Budget, and then they forward that reporting and the job numbers to the federal government. We also have used these dollars very carefully to avoid a cliff in fiscal 12 by spending these dollars very wisely on one-time items as best we can. The next page, 7, there were guidelines for institutions of higher education with these dollars. We could spend them on education and general expenditures, but in such a way as to mitigate the need to raise tuition and fees for in-state residents, and I'll come back to that in the next slide. And we could use them for the modernization, renovation, or repair of facilities that are primarily used for instruction, research, or student housing. I will tell you there are a lot of reporting aspects to these dollars that have added administrative burden to all of us, but we're coping with that, I think, very well, and it's certainly worth the money because the money's helped us enormously. We cannot use these dollars to increase our endowment, maintain systems, equipment, or facilities, or improve facilities for sectarian instruction, or facilities that charge admission to the general public. So just to be clear, our museums and our athletic departments and football teams, et cetera, have not received and will not receive any of these dollars. Slide 8, how have we apportioned these dollars? The $89.3 million that the university received, we've used approximately 52% of that to mitigate tuition increases, $46.2 million. The single biggest use of that was the Minnesota resident undergraduate tuition mitigation that we worked with the legislature that you adopted in your appropriations bill last year that buys that tuition down, and I'll show you that on the next slide. We've also used it in part to support our middle-income scholarship program that we started in the current fiscal year, and I'll talk about that again in a minute. And then we reserved $43.1 million, slightly less than half of the dollars, as a bridge tool to help units as we were making the big budget cuts that we're making both this year and that we've got to make next year. If you turn to slide 9, this is what we did with the stimulus dollars for Minnesota resident undergraduates, the way your legislation directed us to do that. Tuition, for example, for a Minnesota resident undergraduate in fiscal 10 was $9,600. That increased 7.5% in the current fiscal year. That was an increase of $720. We took $420 per student then, Minnesota resident undergraduate, from the stimulus pool and bought that tuition down to what you can see there is $300 for that student. That then resulted in a net increase of 3.1%. That's exactly what your legislation asked us to do, and that's what we've done. And we've done a similar exercise. We've planned the same exercise for fiscal 11, and your legislation says that we cannot increase it more than $450, which will be about a 4.4% net increase for a Minnesota resident undergraduate, again, using the stimulus dollars to buy that down. And I see a question coming. All right.
Madam Chair?
Senator Weaker.
Over here there is. Mr. Pittsburgher, the tuition is a part of the cost, but what about for all the fees? And you might say we're going to mitigate tuition increase, but fees might not be so good. What is the total price for a full-time student undergrad in addition to the tuition? And not talking about textbooks and...
No, Madam Chair, if you think of it as cost of attendance for a Minnesota resident graduate student living in a dorm on the university, it's a little over $18,000. We've been working quite hard. Our housing and people in particular, despite some rather dramatic increases in food prices, we've been managed to hold those rates. For example, next year's housing rates will only go up 1.5% for a student living in a dorm. So we've tried to, at the same time, hold down that half of the equation in terms of the cost. But you're right, the legislation itself talked about tuition, but we pay attention really more and more these days to the cost of attendance and try to keep that percentage down as well.
And Madam Chair, is there a word for the non-tuition costs that wouldn't be the dorm or food, but you know, for technology fee,
lab
all
fee.
The fees?
Yeah, I think you'd probably in general call those collegiate or student fees.
And what percentage of
average?
That? Yeah, you know the sticker price.
Well, you know, in that roughly $18,000 included the student fee impacts. But whether it's a transportation fee or a collegiate fee or a technology fee the student service fees that go to student groups. It's all in that figure. I'd be happy to come back and itemize. I don't have that itemization, and it's a little complicated because it varies by collegiate unit and campus.
What's a transportation fee?
There's both a fee because there's a discounted MetroPass program, and, of course, there's about a $15 fee on each student that helps pay for the intercampus circulators on the buses to get from St. Paul and around the campus. There's a modest fee on students for that, too. We'd be happy to come back and talk about all of that. We have a fee study underway as well.
Are you going to have a light rail mitigation fee?
Madam Chair, no comment on that.
Sounds like this is a good item for discussion, is how much fees add to the tuition.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, my point was that there's an additional 80% or more that the student is paying, or their parents, or the on loan. And so while we say we're mitigating the tuition,
there's still the other expenses.
A lot of other out of pocket, and you realize that. And
yeah, Madam Chair and Senator, and that's why it is important. And we do report when we bring the budget to the board every spring, not only what the tuition increase is, but we show them the increase in the cost of attendance. Okay. So we count everything when we're, and the board's fully aware of what that increase is.
Thank you.
Just to remind you again on slide 10 that in addition, in this example here of the middle income scholarship support, in addition to that $420, you can see it there in the red, $420 federal stimulus buy-down. There was an increase in the Pell and the state grant for this particular student with a family income of between $40,000 and $60,000. And then there was the new $1,500 middle income scholarship program as well. So for this particular student, in the current fiscal year, they saw nearly a 21% drop in tuition. And I just want to emphasize this again, between the federal stimulus, what the state did, what the federal government did, and what we've done with the middle income scholarship, we drove tuition down substantially for students with a family income up to $100,000. There were good things done for students despite the hard cuts that everybody's taking. And I think we all need to keep that in mind. Turning to slide 11, of the remaining $43 million of federal stimulus money, that wasn't used for tuition mitigation for Minnesota resident undergraduates, we allocated for the current fiscal year $27.6 million that benefited 25 academic and support service units funding over 35 different projects and initiatives at the university. We did not allocate all of those dollars. We could have allocated them all, but we chose not to because we suspected that another budget cut was possible in fiscal 11, and we wanted to wait to see what that cut was and have some flexible money at our disposal to, again, help mitigate the impacts. As I said earlier in my remarks, this journey from nearly $703 million down to $591. So we will be allocating in this year's budget deliberations at the university that are underway now for fiscal 11, an additional $15.5 million of one-time federal stimulus money, again, with the goal of preserving jobs as long as we can and finding ways to reduce costs on this glide path to this $591. If you turn to the next page, of that $27.6 million, roughly $15.7 million went to bridge lower FTEs. For example, in facilities management on the Twin Cities campus, who through the budget cuts that had to occur this year, had to reduce 30 employees in the custodial ranks. We provided them federal stimulus dollars as a way to retain those employees, because there is turnover, and we're hopeful that in the normal turnover in employees, that the employees that otherwise would have been laid off had we had no stimulus money will be able to find their way into a permanent job because we've had a vacancy that came along during the course of the year. We don't know if we're going to be able to save them all, but the federal stimulus money is giving us that glide path in many instances at the university. We also spent $6.5 million of it on academic program initiatives. We spent a little bit mitigating tuition and fee increases at both the Humphrey Institute and the law school to help them on some financial aid for students. And we spent some in service units. Examples on page 13 give you a little more specifics. We spent some of those dollars retaining graduate assistance positions in College of Biological Sciences, CLA, the Medical School, Duluth Institute of Technology. We've been using some of those dollars to increase the wireless network coverage on the Twin Cities campus, something people probably aren't directly aware of. The Vet Diagnostic Lab. In this economic downturn, the Vet Diagnostic Lab at the University of Minnesota, the hospital, had to cut nearly 86 positions because people quit bringing their pets in for treatment. To be frank, the bottom fell out of that area of that operation. It's a fee-for-service operation, and the bottom just fell out. We've used some federal stimulus money to help them. That's one of those indirect impacts to the university that you don't always hear about because they're not necessarily funded by the state. They're funded by the fee-for-service, but the bottom just fell out because it was one of those discretionary expenditures that people gave up on as the economy soured. We've used money to improve recruitment and retention at Crookston. I don't specifically know what the mega genome project is on the Mississippi watershed, but we've also been bridging some of the budget cuts in many of the schools, design and nursing, et cetera. I'll stop there and turn to my colleague or stand for questions about anything with respect to the federal stimulus money.
So this whole idea of bridging cuts, is that where, you know, you have to give, like, notice, layoff notices? Yeah.
In some cases, yes. And frankly, Madam Chair and members, where we have reduced TA positions or graduate assistance, we've been able to use the stimulus money to retain those folks. And we're going to work hard to try to rebuild those budgets, but it's going to be difficult. And at the end of 11, we'll probably see fewer TAs and fewer graduate assistants as a result.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen.
So, Madam Chair and Mr. Fitzenreiter, so what happens for 12-13 when there is no federal stimulus money?
Well, we've been very careful, as careful as we can, not to spend those dollars in a manner in which they're recurring expenditures. But let's take the amount of money we spent on financial aid for Minnesota resident undergraduate students. A substantial portion of the federal stimulus money was spent on that. Now, that was good for students for this biennium. They paid less money than that. But a returning student, of course, will face an increase because that scholarship, that federal stimulus scholarship, will be gone. In the case of facilities management, if we haven't managed to have enough turnover, let's say of those 30 positions, we use federal stimulus money, those folks are still at the university. But if we only find 15 of them jobs through the normal turnover in facilities management, 15 of them are going to be out without a job. And they've been informed of that. So we've given notice.
Are you finding that you're having less retirements than normal?
Well, in this economy, there is not as much turnover. That's correct.
So, Madam Chair, so the money is recurring. At least if you're a student paying tuition, it's recurring.
Madam Chair, as I said, the financial aid will disappear, and that for a returning student, they will see a jump in their tuition. We talked about that when this program was set up. And I can say that it's a benefit for students now, but it will catch up. And the Board of Regents and the President are cognizant of that, and we're thinking a lot about what might be done to mitigate that. But at this point, we don't have an answer. And, of course, I think everybody knows we're going to face more cuts in 12 and 13.
Yeah, so, Madam Chair, Mr. Fitzgerald, obviously, your experience is not only limited to what, well, in fact, both of you, Ms. King and Mr. Fitzenreiter, you know, given your previous lives in state government, or Ms. King as Commissioner of Finance and Mr. Fitzenreiter as the principal fiscal analyst for the House, both of you know what we face next year, the impact on higher education. And the reality is I think, I mean, it's not exactly a secret to anybody around this table, where we expect the elections this fall to make a difference to some extent in congressional membership, there won't be any more federal stimulus money. That's pretty clear. And the impact that's going to have translated down to the level of students at the University of Minnesota in the Minscu system is going to be significant, because obviously we're not going to get out from under where the economy is taking our budgets.
Madam Chair, Senator, I couldn't agree more. It will be, for a returning student, a pretty severe impact when they come back in 12.
Senator Roebling.
I was just interested in this program where you were working to improve recruitment and retention at Crookston, and I'm wondering if it's been successful, if you've seen any numbers yet, and I'm also wondering about attendance at Morris, so that your two most outlying campuses, how are they doing?
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Madam Chair, Senator, Crookston's doing very well. They're appealing to international students and doing much better than they were 4 or 5 years ago. So I think, frankly, their enrollment's doing pretty well.
Isn't it Chinese students?
Yeah, yes, ma'am, Madam Chair. Morris has had some financial struggles of late, but I think we've kind of put a SWAT team around Morris, and we're helping them right-size their budget. They had some stress on the number of students, but they're, in my opinion, turning themselves around. I would say 2 years ago they weren't in great shape. I think they're getting better.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
So this recruitment and retention, is it in-state or international recruitment and retention?
Madam Chair, it's really an effort to increase the profile and visibility of Crookston, so it's not specifically targeted international or local. It was an effort just to get the word out, get more brochures out, get more information out about Crookston in general into the marketplace. I don't have them with me. I could bring you some figures about how that's impacted the number of applications at Crookston and for this fall and this past year that they're actually up. And I'll bring you those statistics.
Sure.
Site visits. Take the kids out of the high school and take them to the college. Then they fall in love. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you do receive international students, do they then pay non-resident tuition?
Madam Chair, yes.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, they do? I thought Crookston and Morris didn't charge non-resident tuition.
I can't remember them all. I apologize. I guess at Crookston they don't. I know they do on the Twin Cities.
I'm thrilled that I knew something you didn't know.
Yes. It could be my age.
Ms. Peterson just told me.
Madam Chair, it could be my age. I'm 58 on Saturday.
No,
I'm feeling
older,
old.
So it doesn't count. Okay, we need to move on to Ms. King. Thank you very much, Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I too, was asked here today to talk about how we've used the federal stimulus funds. Like the university, we received about $79 million in federal stimulus funds, which represented about half of what we had in a state budget cut. So that brought our net budget cut down to about $75 million for the 10-11 biennium. We had a slightly different strategy. We used about a third for tuition mitigation and two-thirds for operating budget assistance, and we used the our tuition strategy really was to buy down the 10 rate rather than using a portion of it for each year. So we have created what amounts to a two-year buy down for the 10 tuition rate, and then in fiscal 12, it'll come back up like the university's expectation. Of the roughly $50 million that we used for operating budget support, We distributed that out to the campuses through our normal allocation method, and they are using it for operating budget assistance. This is a great source for us for things like the early retirement program, which has a large one-time cost, but it enables us to bring down our structural costs once we've paid those one-time costs. We also have used it for equipment purchases. We've used it for program development. Again, like the university, we were very, very mindful about this being one-time money, and also very mindful that it was the only opportunity we were going to have to finance our way down to a lower state appropriation level. And so we were very mindful of that in our discussions with the campuses. It's about 2% of our expected spending in fiscal 10, and so it doesn't represent a large distortion, but it does represent a very useful one-time pot for us to adjust budgets over the next several years. It was appropriated to us in a bill structure that loaded most of the money into fiscal 10. We chose to spread it out between 10 and 11, and we're spending it pretty evenly between those 2 years. We will have about half of it spent at the end of this fiscal year, and we'll have the balance spent by next September, which is the expiration date in the law. We provided direction to the campuses to steer this money away from facilities projects because they have operating budget resources for that, and the federal reporting requirements around facilities uses were just so extraordinary that we thought the risk of error was so high when we're distributing this money to 50 places that we just asked them not to use it that way and to find some other device in their budget to move money around if they had a facilities requirement. Madam Chair, that really represents as much as I have to say.
Okay, thank you. Then thank you both very much. Then we have four items left in our agenda. We have about 10 minutes for each, so we'll have to move kind of quickly. First, we're going to hear from the OLA and from Minsky on the workforce programs report. I think it's just a small portion. Most of this relates to DEED. We may not even need 10 minutes. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourselves for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jody Hauer. I'm with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And as the Chair suggested, I'm going to talk about just one of the several recommendations in the workforce programs evaluation that we released this year. In your packet, you have a copy of the summary from that report, and it's entitled Workforce Programs. If you were to look at that, the recommendation I'm going to talk about is the fourth bullet down under key recommendations. And that has to do with the recommendation that the Office of the Chancellor do more in terms of identifying colleges in the system that offer flexible academic programs that accommodate the needs of laid-off workers. And I'm going to get into an explanation of how we arrived at that recommendation. But from our research, we concluded that there are some gaps in service for Minnesotans who need help with workforce development, because workforce programs are only partially integrated with many workforce-related entities, and one of those entities is Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. As part of our work, we visited each of the 16 workforce service areas around the state of Minnesota, and we talked with managers of the programs that are offered through those workforce centers around the state. And we asked them many questions, but one of the things we asked them about was how well coordinated are their programs in the workforce centers with the Minsky colleges that are in their immediate environs. And many of the workforce program managers that we interviewed told us that Minsky's academic structure creates some issues for workforce clients, and in particular for laid-off workers. One of the issues is that workers who are laid off anytime in the first half of any given calendar year typically have to wait months to begin their training, because the training and courses offered on the Minsky campuses typically start either in the fall or sometimes in the January semester. And some of those program managers also told us that some of the laid-off workers don't even enroll in some of the programs because the programs are many times 2 years in length, and these laid-off workers are relying on their unemployment insurance benefits, which they expect to run out before they'd be able to complete a program of that length of time. We also interviewed representatives in the Office of the Chancellor, and also talked with some of the academic deans and other representatives in a small number of the colleges around the state. And we focused with them on the academic programs, not with customized training, but on the academic programs, because the workforce clients really need to get an academic credential or certificate from the programs that they take when they're involved in training. And from the discussions we had, we concluded that MNSCU has been actively involved in trying to help laid-off workers to address their education needs and their training needs. But we also concluded that additional steps really need to be taken. And let me talk about that here. We do know that some of the MNSCU colleges, and I'm focusing on the two-year colleges here, some of those colleges have redesigned certain academic programs in order to accommodate needs of laid-off workers. I'm going to talk about briefly Anoka Technical College because it was one that we interviewed. They now have four programs that have multiple start times throughout the course of a year so that a laid-off worker can start not just in the fall but any one of those multiple start times. The college has also collaborated with the Anoka County Workforce Center in ways to add extra sections to accommodate cohorts of the laid-off workers as they come through the programs in the Workforce Center and want to begin. The college has been very good in accommodating that by adding additional sections. It's redesigned some of its programs in ways that it has accelerated the schedule so that the laid-off workers can complete the program in advance of the typical two-year program timeline. The college has also modified some of its student support services to help out the dislocated workers because, as you know, someone who's been at a job for 20 years and then been laid off is going to have very different needs than a student who just graduated from high school a couple years ago. And so they've keyed in their counselors to help accommodate some of those needs from the dislocated worker's viewpoint. Now, the college made a lot of those changes based in part on its interactions and its collaborations with the Anoka County Workforce Center, but it also took some additional steps. It convened some focus groups of dislocated workers to help themselves at the college understand what do we need to do to help out this group of students. Now, the Office of the Chancellor has also done some things to help out the laid-off workers. One of the things is that it has a campus-by-campus network now of contact people who can help identify what are some of the best practices in working with the laid-off workers. And it also has a system director that it hired last year to, at least in part, work with DEED on specific needs of the laid-off workers. So those, of course, are good things. But we did conclude that additional action is needed. We think that, in our opinion, that the system office's work has been focused too heavily on the customized training side of their programs and not enough on the academic programs. Plus, the MNSCU colleges do offer many short-term certificate-type programs, but the system and the colleges don't track how many of the students using those programs are laid off workers, and they can't tell us. They don't know whether those programs really are helping meet the needs of laid off workers. So this led to our recommendation that the Office of the Chancellor should, first of all, identify all of those colleges that are similar to Anoka Technical College that already are doing some things to accommodate the needs of the laid off workers, and then take the next step in helping other colleges determine whether they too should change or modify the programs in some way to help meet those specific needs on their own campuses. So with that, Madam Chair, I would conclude and answer any
Thank
questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Hauer. And you don't look like Mary Rothschild.
I am, though.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I was thinking of a different Mary Rothschild. Welcome, Mary Rothschild.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mary Rothschild. I am a system director in the Office of the Chancellor for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and I do work closely in the area of workforce development and the strategic partnerships that we have with a variety of other state agencies, DEED, Adult Basic Education, and the Workforce Center system. In general, the Office of the Chancellor and the Minnesota State College and University system does agree with the Office of the Legislative Auditor report that we can do more to offer academic programs for dislocated workers. We have a variety of mechanisms where we try and work with our colleges and universities to provide those options. We do recognize that in our state, we're trying to meet the needs of nearly 2 million Minnesotans who are working learners, people who have some college but no degree, have only a high school education, or are high school non-completers, as well as all of the dislocated workers. So we recognize that there's a very large population of people who do need very flexible educational programming to meet than where they are in their education. We have about 650 programs that we identify as short-term programs. They are ones that are 37 credits or fewer, and we've publicized those heavily. And as Ms. Hauer noted, we have many colleges with excellent examples of the way they've adjusted their programming, academic, for-credit programming to meet the needs of the dislocated workers. And we are in the process of surveying our colleges and universities because the data systems that we use currently do not automatically pull those programs that have multiple start dates. They might be short-term, but they might still also start on the traditional academic calendar. We don't pull the multiple start dates automatically from our system. So we're going through a process, as the auditor recommended, to survey all of our colleges and universities and compile that information. So we should have that in a couple of months, or a month or so. I would point out that there are a few reasons why we have found ourselves in this position. One is that we've worked very hard to create a system where students can find a consistency or a continuity among all of our colleges and universities with a uniform start date of a fall semester and a spring semester, which of course also reflects the fact that we are no longer on the quarter system, which was many years ago that was transitioned from quarters to a semester. So we have trade-offs. We have tried to make it easier for students to be enrolled in multiple institutions by having common start dates, and yet it has the perhaps unintended consequence of not being able to allow our academic programs to begin and mm-hmm. change, you know, regularly. Mm-hmm. And I think that as we've worked with our colleges and universities, the example of Anoka Technical College is a very good one. The programs that are short-term in nature are often where we hope the jobs will be in the future. They tend to be in the healthcare area, information technology, and some of the areas where, unfortunately, the wages aren't great, but they're the service occupations. And we do feel as though many of those programs, like nursing assistant, that's available not only on the college campus for credit, but is also offered in many other places around the state, and people can at least start a job in that place, in that occupation, and then hopefully continue on because they get credit for the nursing assistant becoming a practical nurse or a registered nurse. So with that, I would be happy to answer any other questions that the members might have.
Any questions on this issue? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to talk a little bit about the workforce centers that are co-located on Minsku campuses, and my understanding is that there are currently six in our system. And more specifically, one of the items that appeared in the recent bonding bill was such a center at the Rochester Community and Technical College that was subsequently vetoed. It was an $8.5 million request to co-locate that workforce center on the campus. And as a part of the veto message, and I'm quoting, the legislative auditor's report on workforce training stated no clear advantage in locating workforce centers on campuses. And I think this is a good opportunity today to clarify what the legislative auditor's report actually says regarding this issue, and it's on page 4 of the summary that we've been provided. And what it says in part is that locating workforce centers on Minsku campuses can be beneficial for certain workforce clients, but the benefits are not automatic and largely depend on local conditions. In Rochester, this issue has been under debate for the past decade. There have multiple partners have been involved in the discussion, and I'm pleased to say that it has the support of our business community and our higher education community, as well as our workforce center locally. So I'm hopeful that we'll see a return to that project and appreciate the opportunity to clarify.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Ms. Hauer.
Senator Lynch, I would like to add, you're correctly characterizing it. Earlier this week, Jim Nobles, the legislative auditor, did send a letter to the governor clarifying that, pointing out that the veto message was misleading in the statement that he made, and it was misleading. It was not an accurate characterization of what we said in the report. And what we do conclude is that location of workforce centers on campus can have benefits, and there are examples of that now. But we also can't assume that they're going to be automatic, because there are some situations where it simply wouldn't make sense. Mm-hmm. And we did not, in this evaluation, look in depth at the proposal for the Rochester Community and Technical College, so I can't comment on that. But I do want you to know that our office did send a letter to the governor with that message.
Yes, Ms. Rothschild.
We have also looked at the benefits of co-location from kind of a system level. We have asked our colleges and universities, both those that have co-located workforce centers on college campuses and those that do not, how they work with their college and university colleagues, with the workforce center staff. And in general, I have to say that the position that the Office of the Legislative Auditor took is probably fairly accurate. I think that one of the things that we have noticed among our college and university staff is that what really one of the major benefits is there's really a shared culture around that supports training, not just job placement, when these centers are co-located, or when the center is co-located with a campus. There become more formal arrangements for interaction and referral of workforce center clients with the college for assessment of the student learning, shared placement in courses, and sharing data on the success of those individuals. Very often we see that there's joint programming that develops between the workforce center because they understand the local workforce needs more deeply perhaps than the college would. And we see, for example, the opportunity for people to kind of tell their story to workforce center clients, people who have gone through the college and now come back and work with the workforce center. They tell their story about going to college to try to get over that fear of, you know, being on a college campus. And then another benefit are often they hire joint grant writers. And so we've seen some evidence that federal grants are more easily obtained when there is a co-location because they really have this deep working relationship. So there are these benefits. I can't say that they're a necessary condition, but they're certainly a very important condition that should advance the state in terms of the retraining of dislocated workers. Thank you.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering, when someone comes in who's laid off and they are eligible for a retraining grant through the employment offices or through DEED, how does that work with the Pell and state grants? How much does the retraining grant cover, for example? Because we're hearing that applications for state grants has gone way up because so many people are going back to school who have been laid off. And so do they partner them together, or is there what percent does the DEED grant cover of students' education, and usually for how long? And what is the additional need for state and federal aid?
Madam Chair and
Ms. Rothschild,
I'm not sure I'm able to answer that question for you. I might be able to ask someone from our finance office who's here. My understanding is that the student need is determined first through the state and federal grant programs, and then the workforce center system. If it's an approved Workforce Investment Act program, it has to be part of their educational planning through the workforce center, that grant would then cover the balance. But I might have to turn to someone who might know more. Oh, they left. I'm sorry. We might have to get back to you on that question. We could put together a scenario of how the funding follows an individual who has arrived at a workforce center and is approved for training. And again, it has to be in a Workforce Investment Act certified program to start with. And then, again, my understanding is that they do their student financial aid first, and then the unmet need would be met by the workforce center grant. But I can confirm that for you.
That would be interesting.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair. Any other questions?
I could give a partial response to
Senator
Roebling's question.
Sorry, Ms. Hauer.
In regards to the part of your question about how much is spent then by the workforce center program on the individual student, that's going to vary from workforce service area to service area. I know that, for instance, in Hennepin County, the amount that they have said could be spent on training for an individual who qualifies is far lower than elsewhere just because the demand has been so great. So they've decided the way they're going to handle that is say, I can't tell you the exact amount. It might be $1,500. It might be some other amount. I don't remember off the top of my head what that amount is. But they set a limit, a ceiling, and they said we can spend $1,500 on you for training, but we can't go above that. Now, other workforce service areas do not have similar ceilings set for the amount spent per client. So you'll find a different response as you look around the state.
Madam Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, and Ms. Hauer. I'm not finding it in the report. Maybe it's in here. But did you conclude if we have enough workforce centers, if we have too many workforce centers, and assuming that we have the right number, were they staffed adequately?
Ms. Hauer.
Madam Chair and Senator Tomasoni, we didn't ask that question. We didn't try to answer the question of whether the 49 workforce centers that are now open are sufficient or whether there should be more or fewer. So we didn't look at that question. In terms of the staffing, it's a more complicated answer, in part because of the stimulus money that did come to the state in 2009 and will also be available for use in this coming year, because that has been used to increase the number of people out in the workforce centers. Of course, the fact is, that as you talked about a few minutes ago with University of Minnesota and MNSCU, that that's one-time funding. When we spoke with the Workforce Service Area directors about this very topic, several of them indicated their concern that once this federal stimulus money leaves, they're going to be facing some predicaments that they saw earlier and that they are going to have insufficient number of people in the workforce centers to accommodate the people that come in to use the online job bank and some of the other services that are available for anybody at no cost.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, why don't we go on to the occupational programs? There's no more questions on workforce programs.
Madam Chair, I will talk. Again, you have in your packets a summary of this evaluation that came out last year, so in 2009, on MNSCU occupational programs.
And I think we did have you in, but we had a very short time, which I hope isn't going to happen again today.
I will focus only on, again, just part of the recommendations, the ones that I understand you're most interested in. And if you are following along in this or using the summary, I'm going to be talking about number two, the second bullet under key recommendations, and also the fifth one, so the penultimate one. But I'll talk first about the fifth bullet listed there, which has to do with the program advisory committees that MNSCU colleges have for their occupational programs. First of all, so that we're all on the same page, I would just remind you that that particular evaluation had a purpose of trying to understand how well MNSCU's occupational programs, like programs for nursing assistants or welders or computer programmers, how well do those occupational programs respond to employers' needs and to industry's needs. So with regards to that, we talked to a number of the colleges, and we talked with them and found out about the various strategies they use to understand what are the employers' needs, what do industries need for workers. And one of the things that the colleges rely heavily on are their program advisory committees. Now, you may know somewhat about them, but just to give you a little sense that we're all operating with the same understanding, the colleges are required by Board of Trustee policy to have program advisory committees in place for every one of their occupational programs. And they consist of employers, these committees, as well as others, some educators. And the purpose behind having these program advisory committees is to provide guidance to the colleges in their decisions about how to operate their programs, when to start them, when to close them, et cetera. We took a look at those program advisory committees, and we found that not all of those program advisory committees are operating very effectively. Some of them, are quite inactive. Some don't meet often enough to be effective. Some are too large. Some had 50 or more members. Some are too small. Some had 3 or 4 members. There were some that had insufficient turnover, and the college presidents we interviewed told us that they were concerned that the amount of turnover was so insufficient that there wasn't enough new blood coming in to generate new discussions and help for the actual occupational programs. Some of the committees had too few people on them who were representatives of business and had relevant experience. We did a survey of the committee members on those advisory committees, and some of them told us that their committees were just underutilized, the colleges weren't using them well, and that in a few cases, some members said that they thought that the committee was only in place because there was a requirement to have one. Mm-hmm. The college really didn't feel like there was much value to it, but they had to have it because it was by board policy required. So we recommended that the colleges provide better oversight of those program advisory committees. They need to take some steps to improve those committees that aren't fulfilling their potential. And the problems that we found were not indicative of all of the program advisory committees, but there were enough of them that had some of those problems that we thought it was important to talk about. Another way that the colleges try to understand how well their programs are meeting economic conditions and employers' needs is in what they call their academic reviews. Now, by board policy, all the colleges are required to regularly review their academic programs. It's the colleges themselves that determine how often to do that and what process to follow. Well, we looked at a sample of the program reviews that were done from 13 of the colleges that we had visited as part of our evaluation. And we found that in those program reviews that most colleges looked at job prospects for graduates by looking only at past employment trends. So they looked back. And, of course, that's helpful to do. But most of the reviews did not look at current job openings, nor did they look at employment forecasts. And we thought it was important that they do both. That they do, yes, of course, you want to look at the trends, the historic trends, but you also want to see what are the current openings and what are the employment forecasts to help you in your decision about whether this program is meeting the market needs for the particular kind of graduates that would come from the programs. Now, when it came to closing programs, we found that the college's decisions on program closures were driven largely by two things, student enrollment and costs. They've in very few respects, ever looked at job prospects for the graduates when making decisions about closing programs. Now, we looked at a sample of cases for program closures, and in the ones that we examined, colleges just didn't use labor market data in their proposals to close the programs. I do want to explain that we did this work back in 2008, right. Released the report in early 2009. We were aware that at the end of 2007, the Board of Trustees did implement a new policy that would require colleges to document labor market demands when they conduct their proposals for closing programs.
And Ms. Heller, on that line, because we had that controversial issue of the carpentry program at MCTC, I did ask for more information from President Davis, and his program review process did include projected labor market conditions. So it does sound like some of that policy is starting to be implemented.
Madam Chair, I think that's correct. Mm-hmm. So we did recommend last year that the colleges that do not currently use labor market data when they're making their assessments of how well their programs are operating to require that kind of an assessment. So they do look at what the supply of graduates will be and what other workers are already out in the workforce to determine how well that matches and to determine whether they need to make some changes to their occupational programs. We also said that colleges need to account for, the most recent changes, not just those historic trends. And for the program closures, we thought it was important that they look at that gap between anticipated job growth and the supply of workers already out in the labor force. Madam Chair, I could go into some more detail about other things we found, but in the interest of time, maybe I'll leave it up to you. If you think I should, I'd be glad to talk a little bit more about some of the other things we found.
I think I'd be more interested in hearing from Ms. Rothschild about what kind of changes that Minsky's implemented in response to your program, because I think we did see this last year.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'll just make a couple of points about the program advisory committees to start with. One is that our Board of Trustees at its meeting just the other day heard a first reading of a new policy on program advisory committees requiring the colleges and state universities to look at their career and technical education programs and review the program, the composition of those program, putting into policy program advisory committee requirements for what those should look like and addressing some of the issues in the Office of the Legislative Auditor report. And we've also got a new handbook for our colleges and universities on program advisory committees. This was funded by the Carl D. Perkins Federal Funding in connection with the Career and Technical Education Act of 2006, and trying to improve those committees where you have both the K-12 system, the transition of students from high school into college, as well as your industry partnerships that are required as part of those program advisory committees. So we've been doing training using that new handbook over the past year, as well as the board policy. In terms of the second recommendation around labor market, we do have the policies, of course, but I think the other emphasis that we've tried to do is create additional tools for the colleges and universities to use to project labor market needs in the future, this supply and demand. And we do have a new labor market data tool that has been available to all of the colleges and universities. We've contracted for that. It does use the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics, but it goes a little bit deeper than that in terms of doing projections at a kind of a more granular level, both in terms of occupations as well as geographic areas, so the colleges can be very responsive to their local market needs. And we've done training using that tool as well, and providing that to all of our chief academic officers and their institutional research staff so that we can enhance that. Our Associate Vice Chancellor Leslie Mercer may answer more of these questions when we get to the program closure piece, because it interfaces with the policies that we have in the system for program new programs as well as program closures. So I'll just stop there, and she may be able to answer other questions.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Any questions from members of the committee? Senator Tomasoni, have you had them before you to talk about these two reports? Oh, it's interesting. And I think this whole issue of not basing your decisions on, in a sense, student demand and cost, but more being more practical, therefore more directive to students about what the labor market is going to be in the future and their chances of finding jobs. So the last thing, you know, we can't always determine that, but to have that mismatch where we have students being trained to go into a certain profession, there are no jobs there, and then we have a shortage in another area, the more we can do to try to mitigate that so we actually are training and educating our students for real jobs that are out there, I think is really part of our responsibility. Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Rothschild. I believe Dave Olson's still the chair of the MNSCU.
He is.
Senator Pepperdine. Yes, that is true.
And with his regular job as the president of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, representing the businesses, that's an ideal alignment of achieving these objectives, you would think. Right. And you know, I would hope, that I assume that you know, Mr. Olson has read each of these reports, because you know that would be their mission to, you know, create jobs, retain jobs, a prepared workforce, and you have suggestions, and you have, you know, the institutions, you know, headed up by a private sector job builder, so you know that jumps out at me significantly, and I'm, you know, just hoping there's, you know, action plan by the leadership so that when we hear this next year or get an update that we can show that each of these recommendations have been implemented.
Ms. Rothschild.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to mention that we have really had tremendous leadership from our Board of Trustees in trying to reach out to the businesses in the state of Minnesota and ask them what their workforce needs are. In fact, in the past year, we asked, the Chancellor asked all of our presidents to visit 10 businesses on behalf of the Minnesota State College and University system. And we took the information from those 10 visits. It resulted in over 350 business visits across the state. And we've compiled that into a report. And if the committee wouldn't mind, we'd be happy to deliver a copy of that report that talks about the workforce needs of the future from those business visits. And again, we credit the leadership of our system to asking our presidents to do that kind of outreach.
We'd be very interested, and I bet Senator Tomasoni's committee would also be very interested in seeing that report.
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
And I think you make a really good point, because we have two glaring examples of what were perceived to be huge needs in the workforce, and one of them was the electricians, And there's a whole bunch of electricians that aren't working, but we're still training them. And the other one, I think, was nurses. And people are still telling me we need RNs and that we need nurses. And yet I've been getting phone calls from all kinds of nurses saying the whole class graduated and not one of them could find a job. And so,
well, we also have an issue with teachers, elementary teachers in particular, and a shortage of special ed teachers. Mm-hmm. And
but those are four-year things. These are kind of mm-hmm. two-year things that we're trying to focus on and move quickly so people can get into new occupations.
Good
and
point.
If we got bad if we got bad information about job availability, but we're training people for those jobs, it becomes a serious issue, I think.
Ms. Rothschild.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasotti, we are actually doing a study of the nursing employment needs in the state currently, and we should have the first draft of that report available for our leadership council, our presidents, who asked for the study to be done so that they can adjust their program enrollments appropriately. We should have that done in early May.
Another student I met with from St. Catharines said she was switching from nursing to another public health education instead, probably in response to this nursing situation. Senator Erickson-Ropes, do you think that there'll be a demand, it'll rebound the need for nursing in the future since the baby boomers are coming up and getting sick and getting old?
Madam Chair, none of us have a crystal ball, but I would imagine that anyone that chooses a field or career in any of the allied health care professions or nursing is going to have plenty of opportunity for a career. Right now, I think it's mostly due to the economy that while severe and it's going to be difficult for the next couple of years, I think after that, you know, we're all hopeful it's going to rebound. And we do have a huge population. People are going to continue to demand services.
Okay. And let's bring Leslie Mercer up from Minsky, who's going to talk to us a little bit more about program closure. And don't worry, Senator Bonner, if we will get to your bill.
Madam Chair, just a quick comment in between.
Yes, Senator Roebling.
I know we've talked about this a little before, but if Minsky cuts down on classes that are in high demand for students, things students really think they'd like to go into, the private sector often picks those students up, and they'll offer the courses and oftentimes charge more. So it's not always a great thing to have them disappear in one program and as long as the student demand is there, unless the students are re-educated to know for sure that there aren't good employment opportunities, they may still seek out what they want to study.
And I think you're right that some will still seek that out, but some, when given good career information, will maybe choose something that's close to what they want, like public health instead of nursing, but where there's more job opportunities available. Ms. Mercer.
Thank you very much, and I'll be brief because I know you don't have a lot of time. I'm Leslie Mercer. I'm Associate Vice Chancellor in Academic Affairs at the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and I think my task today is to briefly explain to you how we do program closures. Let me start by saying that I think this does blend into the conversation that you just had to a great extent, because as we offer programs, we really do consider three things. First and foremost, we consider student interest, and especially for occupational and career programs, the job market, the job opportunities, the employer demand. And, of course, then we have to also consider the cost of the programs. And so those three things are things that we have to balance as we do this. And when I say we, I mean primarily the campuses. The decision to close programs is primarily a campus-based issue, and I'll talk in a minute about how the Office of the Chancellor is involved. The closure program process really begins often with a review of programs, which you were just talking about, and campuses look at such things as the size of the enrollment, the placement of the graduates, the cost of that program, the need for that particular program in the future, as well as the current employment trends. And based on that, they consult on campus with various people as well. And many times they also talk to their program advisory committees and to other affected persons. Based on those results, they may request that a program be closed. They have many, many options. Sometimes they request a suspension, which means that it's sort of put on, as it implies, suspension and can come back within 3 years. And that's often done if they think that it's just a temporary, for example, perhaps there's a temporary oversupply of something, but they're not sure that that would stay that way. They would probably prefer to suspend the program and then bring it back when the need arises. The other option is program closure. And closures do, by board policy, require the approval of the chancellor. And so thus the Office of the Chancellor does get involved. And when an application for closure comes into the Office of the Chancellor, there has to include in it reasons for the closure, which could include such things as the need for that program, the student enrollment trends, the employment of the graduates, or financial circumstances, and some other factors. But those four are the primary needs. The role that the Office of the Chancellor then takes in that process is, first of all, to ensure that that process is followed so that we have a common way of doing this. And part of that process includes the posting of that information on a listserv that all the campuses have access to so that other campuses know that an institution is considering closing a program. There's a couple reasons for that. One is that we want to make sure that everyone isn't thinking about closing the same program, and also give campuses an opportunity. And this does happen at times, and this is part of the role of the Office of the Chancellor, to kind of broker these programs. So perhaps I'll give you a concrete example. A few years ago, Southeast Technical College decided to get rid of their aviation mechanics program. They looked at the numbers, the cost of the program, the number of students they were graduating, and the need for aviation mechanics in that part of the state, and concluded it was not a very viable program for them. However, Lake Superior College in Duluth was just starting to gear up because of some contracts with local manufacturers of airplanes. I'm blanking on the name of the airplane.
Cirrus,
thank you. And so we were able to arrange a transfer of that program. So it was closed at one institution, but then moved to another institution.
So, like, you transferred, like, the equipment or the curriculum, or did faculty actually transfer too?
I can't speak to the faculty for sure. I believe that, and this is where I'm getting a little thin ice here, I believe the faculty have the option of transferring if they want to do that under contract. For sure, often when those things happen, we provide the equipment gets moved and the curriculum and many of those other things are either just totally given to the new institution or given to or sent or given to them at a significantly reduced price. So, yes, that does happen. So that's one option, that one thing that can happen as a result of this posting on the listserv and the work that we do. The other thing that we're really feel very strongly about is that we need to make sure that student interests are protected. And so we take very seriously our obligation to support students when a program is going to be closed, which means that the institution, if there are still students in the program, let's say it's a two-year program and they want to close it after year one, we require, first of all, that the institution either complete the program for those students that are already enrolled and allow those students to complete in a timely way, or in some cases, fairly rare exceptions, but sometimes other arrangements are made for those students to go to a different institution, but that's really pretty unusual. But that's something that we do insist upon, that there are no students that are left kind of in the middle of a program. So that's one of the things we do. That is the essence of what we do. Just to give you a sense of how many of these things happen, I checked just before I came over here today, and the most recent complete fiscal year we have, which would be the 2009 fiscal year, there were 73 new programs created and 148 programs closed and 12 suspended. So I think the trend in more recent years has been for slightly more closures than new program creation, and to some extent that is starting to be a reflection of the budgets. And so this is an area where institutions have to make some tough choices sometimes, and that's what they have been doing.
Okay. Thank you. We're probably going to have you come back with more updates, because I'm sure that it's not going to be good news.
down the road.
Correct.
In terms of program closures.
If I could just add one other thing, Madam Chair. When you were talking earlier, I think one of the things that we're trying to do to greater align that student interest and that occupational demand, yesterday, in addition to the policy that Ms. Rothschild talked about, the board also approved, or I guess it was a first reading of a policy, so they'll approve it next month, a policy that is much clearer about providing student career planning information at both the colleges and at the universities for programs that are career or occupational in nature, so that we can hopefully help students understand where there are better opportunities than others and sort of get that student demand, employer interest better aligned. So I wanted to just bring that to you, too.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions? All right, thank you very much, Ms. Mercer. Then Senator Bonoff. And share with you because I gave mine away. This is mine. Senator Bonoff, welcome to the Higher Ed Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, I just saw that I actually brought a different bills folder with me. So if somebody would be so kind as to give me a copy of the bill, and I apologize. I'm sitting here with my bill folder, and it's the wrong one. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is the first time I've been in higher ed. It's good to be here. And I just would like to make a comment that I appreciate seeing the members from E12 also be sitting on higher ed because that's so important that we have the input going in both directions. So that's great. Madam Chair, this is a bill, Senate File 3205, that is very simple in nature. It simply says that when a student goes to register and looks at the syllabus for the course, that they also have the prices of the books that they would be expected to buy. The genesis of this bill came from a student in my district who went to both his representative, Representative Sarah Anderson in the House, and to me. He's a UMD student, lives in Plymouth, and asked us to do this because he is part of student government at UMD, and they have felt as though with everything being so expensive that they want to have the best chance, number one, if they can't afford the books, to perhaps pick a different class that would meet the same objectives, or to have the best chance to be able to then go online and find used books and have other options. There was a federal law passed recently that said the publishers needed to let the professors know the price of these books, but that law did not include having the professors and the universities have to publish the prices for the students. And by the way, the student wanted us people to know that he is on spring break or he would be here as he was in the House hearing.
But instead he's in Miami or
exactly. We have no sympathy, Madam Chair.
Debt accumulates.
So Senator Bonoff, I did talk to you briefly about there's also a federal requirement to do the same thing. And so how does your bill how is it different or how does it augment what the federal requirement is?
Madam Chair, I thought the same thing, and so I called my House author because as I read it, and she assured me, and she could be wrong, but that the federal requirement was a requirement from the publishers to the professors, but it did not state it was also had to be public for the students. And if Mr. Fuller has different information, I would like to see that.
Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, but I'm looking at the law, and you're right, that it does talk about the publisher giving it to the professor, but then it also says that to the maximum extent practicable, each institution of higher education receiving federal financial assistance, which is all of them basically, shall disclose on the institution's internet course schedule and in a manner of the institution's choosing the retail price information related to books.
And Madam Chair, and Mr. Fuller, I believe the concern with that is it doesn't talk about the timing of that, that sometimes happens later, and what we're trying to do is
timely manner
is do it on the syllabus right away so that we ensure that. I leave it to the will of the committee if you don't think that this is necessary. Again, this was a case of students feeling as though they weren't getting this information. It was not happening at their institution, and so it was because of that that this came forward.
Have you heard from any other students other than your particular constituent? Because we have had a student advisory committee on textbooks.
Madam Chair, this student is not speaking for himself. He's speaking for the all UMD. So I've only heard from UMD. He's head of the student something-something group, and so he is speaking on behalf of them, not personally.
Mr. Misakonis, is your student advisory committee still active? Or that? Did you want to comment at all on this bill? Are you part of that advisory committee? Okay. And while you're walking up there, Senator Wicker?
Oh, yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Baugh, thank you for bringing this forward. And I hope we can develop some additional language, not at this moment, but in terms of the concept, Senator Roebling and myself and others worked on the legislation a few years ago leading to the federal law, and actually it was patterned after Minnesota. But to get to the finish line, as you know, there's a number of compromises. We want transparency to the student, and maybe it will go to faculty. It'll get to the bookstore, but what about the student? What about the payer? And that's the message we can't lose sight of. And so we do have language in Minnesota law, and maybe we'll hear that now, that says once a year or so there's information to be provided in general about containing costs. In fact, the policy goal federally is to decrease costs for textbooks and course materials. But I just wanted to offer, Madam Chair, conceptual support, and I've got some suggestions. There's encouraging language for other disclosures in federal law, which at another point as we develop our policy bill, which I believe is on the table. And
our policy bill is already passed and on the floor.
Okay, but there's an opportunity, Madam Chair, for working on that. So I wanted to say yes, and let's work together.
We're going to be done. We have to be out of here at 5:02. Could you introduce yourself, please, for the record?
Chair Megan Fitzgibbon from the Office of Higher Education. And we did provide, as mandated by the statute or legislation last year, a tuition information requirements report that was due when we turned in January 15th. And this was in response to the federal legislation that was passed and the implementation of those requirements that are due to be implemented starting July 1, although a majority of it is already being implemented on college campuses and with publishers. Part of that, as Mr. Fuller explained, there is a portion of it that is related to what publishers have to provide to faculty and those choosing college textbooks on campus. The other portion is about the pricing information, so students can access that information. Now, I think, as Senator Bonnev mentioned, what this student's concern is probably the timing. This is a required as time permits or to the extent possible is from the federal legislation. And as many of you may know, as you're ordering textbooks, usually if you're talking about the fall semester, you might register for those classes in April, May, sometimes even earlier, and you may not find out what the college textbooks are until later in the summer. And I'm sure that's probably what the student's concern is in this situation.
Right, Madam Chair, and thank you. That was the concern, as they wanted it to be when they registered, so they could use that time to scout around for the cheaper books.
Or help them decide.
Right.
Mr. Sampson, did you want to comment on this?
Yes. I'm Bob Crabb, who's the director of the U of M bookstore.
Oh, okay.
He knows the legislation backwards and forwards.
Okay, if you would like to comment, come forward. Mr. Crabb. Come forward.
The bookstore. Okay. Madam Chair,
Mr. Crabb,
committee
thank
members.
You.
Yes. My name is Bob Crabb. I'm director of the bookstores at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, Rochester, Crookston, and Morris campuses. And,
but not Duluth.
Not Duluth, no. We've taken a number of steps since the federal accounting office report 3 or 4 years ago citing the increase in textbook costs. We've consolidated our stores. We closed 3 inefficient stores. We have 1 large, very efficient store now that's improved our financial situation such that we are able now to finance the systems needed to do rental programs, sell ebooks, and we're discounting textbooks to some degree, and we're hoping to increase the level of discounting this fall. We rented 110 titles this last spring. We've got that program ironed out now, and we're hoping to increase that to 800 titles this coming fall. We have been posting the ISBN numbers and prices on our website within 2 or 3 days of the time that the faculty get us their book requests, so students can access that site. They just put in their X.500 identifier, and the next screen they see is a list of all the courses that they're registered for and all the books that are required or optional for those courses with the prices.
Pricing, excellent.
So they can, and the ISBN, so they can take that ISBN copy and paste it into Amazon.com or Big Words or any of the search engines. So we think that we're subject to market conditions, and we're trying to respond as rapidly as we can to the market. It's evolving rapidly with internet e-commerce competition. Amazon has increased their discounting over the last 2 or 3 years substantially, and there are a lot of rent. Chegg is a rental operation that we feel is someone we need to compete with and be right up there with them. So we think we're already posting the prices as requested in this bill. And the only caveat is we're dependent on getting those textbook adoptions from the faculty. Mm-hmm. Some students do, as the previous speaker mentioned, some of the students are registering as early as April, May. A lot of the books are not chosen at that time. The faculty typically wait till spring session is over to convene their groups and decide on textbook needs for the coming semester. So
okay.
We usually don't get
We have to wrap up. Okay. I'm sorry, Mr. Krebs. We're getting kicked out of the room.
Those, excuse me.
Complete your sentence.
We usually don't get the adoptions, a large majority of the adoptions, till July.
Okay.
So
it's one problem.
Yeah.
Senator Weider.
Madam Chair, if it's your intent that we pass this today, I would move it. And recognizing we have a policy bill on the floor and that I'm sure Senator Boff would work with interested stakeholders, I do have some language, but not prepared to do an amendment. I want to share that with her. But I would move that Senate File 3205 be recommended pass and referred to
the floor. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed nay. Motion prevails. Thank you very much,
Senator
Bonoff, and the meeting is adjourned.